is a moral call right here. This is not about politics. This is about morality.
Health emergencies can't wait for us to have some theoretical debate about some better idea that will never, ever come to pass.
Hello, 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 my friends. I am Jillian Mason.
And I am Benjamin Day.
And this is the Medicare for All podcast, the podcast for everyone who needs health care. We are very excited. We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to be going through the latest health care news, including Medicare and Medicaid, hospice care, mifepristone, penile implants, and also we're going to be doing a special interview with one of our local activists in Corpus Christi, Texas, talking about the latest public health crisis in Corpus, which is that we are about to be the first American city to run out of water. Yay! Thank you. Before we launch into that, how are you doing, Ben? How are you doing?
I'm Friday. It's a Friday, so how bad could it be, right? It's all coming to an end for at least two more days.
That doesn't sound like the Ben I know. You should be irritated and upset all weekend long, like me.
Are you projecting? I was going to say.
I am projecting a little bit, maybe. You know, this week I accidentally signed on to a work conference call. I had used my Teams. Well, yeah, right. That was the first big issue, is that I tried to do that. I guess I had last used the Teams app, though, for like a family fun chat or something, like a friends chat.
Your title stood up interesting, perhaps?
Yeah. So my name was set as Auntie Depressant, spelled like I'm your aunt depressant.
Yes.
They apparently had a debate for like 2 minutes about whether to let me in or whether their call was being hacked.
Well, at least you didn't do anything embarrassing on screen while not being aware that the camera was on. This is the classic. Well, this is the standard. So
I do all my embarrassing things on screen while I know the camera is on.
Fair point. Fair point. Yeah. Well, let's do some more of that.
Yeah. Why don't we do that? Why don't we talk a little bit about the latest news in healthcare? I really want to kick it off with something that's very, very glum, but also in a gallows humor kind of way. And that is J.D. Vance's Home Alone moment this week.
Vance's moments are Home Alone moments.
So J.D. Vance goes to do this press conference where he's talking tough about Medicare and Medicaid funding for making a specific announcement about hospice and long-term care. And he begins the press conference by saying, you know, the president is out of town today, and I kind of feel like Kevin McAllister in Home Alone.
Oh, I missed that. Okay, more literal. I thought he was going to be the burglars. That seems more appropriate.
No. He's the one setting up like the iron that swings and hits the American people in the head instead of getting Medicaid.
Okay.
Three guesses why he is he's making threats. Three guesses, Ben. You've only got three.
Why he's making threats?
Why is he making threats? Why is he talking tough?
All right. Is this the part where I pretend like I don't know what we're going to talk about in the upcoming segment?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. Let's see.
This is a really shitty bit.
They're planning healthcare for Iran when they finish the invasion.
That is correct. It is. Khomeini care for all Iranians. Part B.
Yes.
No. So yes. So as really anyone could have anticipated, the issue here is fraud. Not that we don't give people money to pay for their doctor's bills, not that we don't seem to give a fuck whether people live or die, but fraudsters. Ben, you know a fair amount about Medicaid fraud and Medicare fraud.
Mm-hmm. I'm so profoundly disappointed because all available evidence points to that Trump and J.D. Vance really actually love fraudsters, especially successful ones. Admire them and honestly put them into they're leading almost every agency in the federal government at this stage, right?
It's true.
So I don't understand why they're so upset. Wouldn't this be like more of a, let's identify these fraudsters and hire them to run the federal government?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Like, this should be like their kind of like job recruitment program for the cabinet. Yeah.
It's like a pipeline. You need a pipeline of talent. So
pipeline to talent. Where did Kash Patel come in on that pipeline? No. So I guess like that is really the distinction. They like successful fraudsters, and as long as they're unleashing the full powers of the federal government on trying to catch people who are, you know, maybe misfiling a Medicaid claim, we're sure that the people who are committing the least amount of fraud are the most likely to get caught.
Right. And to be clear, I think they're going after the providers here, right? Not the patients.
That is correct. Yeah. Yeah. This is a Medicaid. Yeah. This is for providers. So what he is doing, right, is he's basically saying he is going to stop providers from enrolling in Medicaid and Medicare in states where there's Medicare fraud. And he is, he's also the implication here, right, is that hospices and home health agencies are also halted from new Medicare enrollment for 6 months, right? So even though they're trying to penalize the providers, of course, what that means, right, is that there are fewer hospices and home health agencies to serve people who.
I think we have one maybe rare point of agreement with J.D. Vance here, which is that.
Find it.
Which is that a hospice and home health care is completely filled with fraudsters. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, these are all for-profit companies who are trying to provide as little care as they can and rake in as much Medicare and Medicaid dollars as possible. So they're not wrong on that foundational analysis.
Yes. By the way, I think just to clarify, when Ben says that the hospices and home health agencies are full of fraudsters, he means the companies that run them.
Yes, no. Exactly.
All those fucking cancer patients, they are scamming us.
Just working the system. We all know this to be true.
Damn it. Welfare grandmas. As of course, I feel like we should do like create like a GIF or something that we could just like play, a little loop, but fraud in Medicare and Medicaid isn't the real problem. The real problem is that we have a lot of private companies who are making all the money and yada, yada, yada. Fraud is actually just a very small drop in the bucket, but they love to talk about fraud because it's something that they don't control.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And, I mean, fraud in Medicare and Medicaid is a big problem, has been for decades, and it is for private insurance too. But it is true that it's mostly providers who are defrauding the system. It's not patients. Mm-hmm. It's providers who will double bill, who will upcode their patients and claim that they're being treated for something much more significant than they're actually being treated for. So this stuff does happen all the time. The system gets worked all the time. And there are just like crazy examples of fraud as well.
I was just going to say, am I wrong, though, that it is actually a relative, like the percentage of money, of public money that's, taken up by fraud, that's actually relatively small compared to the entire Medicare or Medicaid budget. And right. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. No, I mean, it's not like fraud in voting where it almost doesn't exist, but it's not a huge number.
But there's actual money in it.
Yeah, exactly.
So some fraud, maybe not enough to justify turning off. He keeps saying we're going to turn off Medicare and Medicaid. Like they're like, like a faucet.
Completely rational to me that they have identified fraud among the current providers.
Yes.
And so therefore they are preventing different providers from entering the program. I don't know. Maybe you should just disenroll the providers that have committed the fraud and not the new providers that have not committed the fraud. They're basically saying we cannot do our job of screening for fraud, and therefore we're going to let the current fraudsters keep working and then prevent any new legitimate and fraudulent providers from entering the system. It's kind of a it's a totally nonsensical response, but I'm sure they'll find some way to weaponize this against Democrats or Democratic state leadership. I don't know how that's going to work, but wait for the next shoe to fall, right?
Yeah, they can give it a shot always, you know. And I invite them to, really. Please explain how the Democrats are responsible for you dozing hospice care, you know?
Yeah, and the background against which this is happening is that there is just an incredible shortage of, I don't know about a shortage of companies, but a shortage of providers
that do
this type of work. So
obviously,
nurses, home health aides, therapists. I mean, there's just a massive shortage across the board of all these providers. And so once you cut off and prevent new providers from entering the market, you could also be potentially exacerbating these shortages. So.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's also, I think, just worth the mention, right? Like who ends up in hospices and home health and you know, getting care from home health agencies. It's, you know,
woke people.
Woke. Yeah. it's your woke as fuck grandma. It's, you know, folks with disabilities who aren't able to leave their home and therefore, you know, get the care inside their home. It's folks who are living in community and therefore want to, you know, get their services there. But it's, you know, again, elders, folks with disabilities, people who are dying, right? Hospices are literally for people who are dying.
Sounds like liberals to me. Yeah.
Turn it off. J.D. Vance is such a disgusting little goblin. I just am so persistently disgusted with him, despite the fact you would have thought I'd have built up a tolerance by now, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's from their perspective, it's not like old people vote or anything. So I think this is a great policy targeting. It'll, you know, obviously people with disabilities, but also will be disproportionately older people.
Sure.
It is going to be some people who are have very severe medical issues or very limited ability to travel and carry out daily necessities. But also home health care is for people who just need some help and are much more functional and. It's a very common need, obviously, often as family members providing home health care, but through, again, an agency, you need some sort of payment system. So, this could affect a lot of people and add it to the list of things that are going to come back to haunt Republicans in the midterms, I think. So,
all of the, whatever. I was going to invoke the polling, but we all know what that's worth, you know.
Right, yeah. This is some very small comfort also if you are being affected by it. So,
yeah, right. You know, the big chant in the fight for 15 was like, we believe that we will win. We believe that we will win faster, faster, faster.
When we get to the midterms.
Yeah. So when the consultants were in the room, we used to say, the polls indicate that we will win. The polls.
Right. We will. Very inspiring shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Super inspiring. Mm-hmm. But you know, we are seeing all sorts of positive indicators though that folks are getting fucking fed up. And we've got the patients over profits pledge that we've been working on. Been given a lot of shout outs recently. Ben, you were on the team that helped to develop that pledge. Mm-hmm. When you developed it, there were zero signers. Do you know how many there are now?
No, please give me an update.
Almost 500.
Oh fuck yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. It's catching on.
Absolutely.
I think this is kind of where the no fossil fuel pledge was at, you know, two or three years after they launched it and all. So that's
cool. Mm. For those who don't listen when I talk, shout out to my partner, John. The POP pledge is our pledge that basically that candidates and elected officials take, saying that they won't accept money from the worst players in the healthcare industry, like insurance companies and nasty for-profit hospitals and the whatnot. So that is definitely growing. We're seeing more and more legislators signing on to the Medicare for All federal legislation that Bernie and Pramila Jayapal are leading. And a lot of them, without us asking, it's clear that ordinary people who have never been involved with politics before are getting pissed off enough about healthcare that they're actually making that call and in enough numbers to pressure folks to actually take some sort of action. So I think you're right. Right. Their healthcare failures are an organizing victory for us waiting to happen.
Yeah. And this is another one that I'm speaking out of my ass here, so I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems potentially illegal to me to just stop a Medicare program. I mean, this is passed by Congress. All the rules are created by Congress and implemented in regulations. It feels like another thing that's going to end up in court, and either the Supreme Court will screw us or every once in a while justice will prevail.
Yeah, that probably is true. And then in the middle of the chaos, they will continue to profit. And
We need to get healthcare now needs like a team of lawyers. You can get on this all. It's fun.
Yes. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking, wow, we could hire a team of organizers or a team of communications experts.
Nah, that's not how we win things in America.
I like this. And if you're willing to take this case to the Supreme Court, please let me know. Speaking of the courts, they're fucking around with our Mifepristone again, Ben. I don't like it.
What's going on? Give me the update.
Yeah, well, so the U.S. Supreme Court did extend a short-term stay. There are seven double negatives in this, right? But, you know, basically, Louisiana, the Fifth Circuit, they petitioned to stop the production of Mifepristone and stop distributing it over telehealth. In 2023, they actually made it legal to prescribe Mifepristone over telehealth. I don't know whether I actually said this, but Mifepristone is one of the components that's necessary for a chemical abortion, which is why this is relevant. I maybe should have explained that before. Long story short. Basically, Louisiana says that providing Mifepristone to their citizens is actually a violation of the state's anti-abortion law. And so they petitioned the court. It turns out that it's our buddy Alito, who basically, like, he fields, I guess, emergency requests from that district. So Louisiana had filed this petition. There had been a couple of different stays to delay stopping the production of Mifepristone. So basically the court saying, well, y'all can continue to make your abortion pills, you know, for a while until we get this figured out, right? That stay was about to expire. So basically, mail order medication was no longer going to be available, but he did another stay and he was responding. I think this is my favorite part about the story. He ended up making this decision based on an emergency request from manufacturers of the drug.
Our greatest heroes, the drug company, big pharma.
Yeah. So just to trace that back again, in case that was way too confusing, because I did kind of word vomit that a little bit. Abortion pills, Louisiana says no. Supreme Court says maybe.
We'll see.
We'll see. And then the manufacturers of Mifepristone are like, no, bitches, we want our money. We want to sell our pills. And then the Supreme Court's like, well, if there's money on the line, let's hold this off.
And everyone knows, I mean, you did in school, did you do like the basics of the U.S. Constitution, political government, this sort of stuff, elementary school at some point?
I went to public school in New Jersey.
So they taught you God.
No, they taught us the lyrics to, most Bruce Springsteen albums and some.
Okay, well, all right. I take it all back. That's it does seem to me like if I were to summarize this in like real Constitution for Dummies terms, Louisiana is like, hey, we want control over interstate commerce.
Ah, very good.
Isn't that kind of what this is about?
Yes, it absolutely is. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's of course, it's part of this whole like strategy that these like anti-abortion states have, like where they can pass their own little state ban. And that's like cool for them and their state. Right. But they really want more, you know, they really want more. They're not satisfied until I am also not having an abortion, you know? And so, yeah. So, they've been trying all of these different things that are really basically trying to stop the national production and distribution of this medication, which is legal in so many states.
Yeah. And obviously, given what we've already seen with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, this is not a Supreme Court that we want deciding this. I mean, I'd love to say that this is good news that the stay was extended, but we're going to get a ruling at some point. And it's, I actually don't know. I haven't been following this case. Do you know if observers have expectations of what they think is going to come out of this court? I just expect everything to be shit, but that's not a legal analysis.
I mean, it's like really unclear, actually, because I think they've been kicking the can down the road so long. Sorry, that's my favorite expression today. I don't even know what that means. Like, who fucking kicks a can down the road? I don't know. Anyway, the point is they're kicking abortions down the road. And it's very, very unclear, right? So there was that, you know, ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. Ever since then, these states have been trying to pass different regulations that sort of overreach state control, like these trying to ban the national production of mifepristone, or like, for example, right here in Texas, we had a law about traveling outside the state and assisting people with traveling outside the state for abortion, right? All, again, part of this desire to like overreach outside the borders of the state. And for the most part, the Supreme Court has ruled against those or has failed to rule on them, right? Has just continued to delay and drag their feet. And so it's peculiar, I think. I think it's peculiar because you'd think they would be eager to come out with a ruling on this because they were, you know, so excited about overturning Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. Well, this will be another winner in the midterms, not to sound like a broken record.
Wait, do we really think that? No, we don't really think it's going to be a winner, right?
No, I was being sarcastic, like about 50% of what I say. I think this is another loser, right? This is another one that polls very attacks on abortion access are not popular among Democrats or Republicans or independents.
People don't love them. People don't love them. I wonder, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, he keeps on basically like kind of throwing stuff for the MAGA base, tossing out the red meat or whatever.
That's what all this is.
So it's like, okay, is banning abortion pills enough to distract people from the fact that their gas prices are over $4 a gallon, right? Like, Is it?
Somehow I doubt it. Yeah. And I was listening to a podcast the other day about how, you know, oil products also go into fertilizer. So that's going to be a problem, and it's going to drive up food prices and food scarcity and all this other stuff. So I know we like to talk about the gas prices. It's like a standard political talking point, but it's actually all the prices that are really troublesome, including at the supermarket. So, and that also gets impacted by all this other sort of war stuff. But We're going way off the rails here. So what else have we got?
Are we?
Well, rail off the rails from healthcare, I suppose. But yeah,
I'm like honestly, like where are the rails these days, Ben?
That's true.
Yes.
I'm laying on the rails. We all, as a group, got a lot of good company.
So again, you know, kind of the takeaway there is really just that they continue to toy around with our rights to abortion, which of course is healthcare, and everyone deserves healthcare and everyone deserves access to abortions. So there we go. So I had one more story I just wanted to go over with you that I thought was really important from this week. I don't know whether you picked it up, but you know, how do you say it? Is it hantavirus or hantavirus? I've heard it both ways.
I don't know, to be honest. That's a good question.
Hantavirus sounds very...
Audience, we need an audience input here. So please fill us in. Yeah.
I like how it kind of sounds like maybe I'm saying it with a like slight accent if I say hantavirus, you know, like people who say quesadilla or something like that. So yeah, hantavirus. Don't want no hantavirus. Well, Hantaclaus is coming to town.
There you go.
So basically, you know, hantavirus has been, or hantavirus, whatever, has been spreading. So there are, you know, more than 40 people in America, and they are currently being monitored in connection to a hantavirus outbreak that happened aboard, of course, our favorite Petri dishes, cruise ship. So the CDC is reporting that there actually aren't any, like live cases in the US that don't, you know, that don't come from that one particular incident. And they say that it's, you know, they say that, you know, the risk of, you know, to the general public is very low, right? Like,
why does this all sound so familiar?
It's really funny. Yeah, I know. You were thinking it sounds exactly like the typhoid fever outbreak of 1912, right? Oh, no, wait. Maybe.
I remember that one.
Maybe it was 5 years ago then. So that's a thing, you know, and just one of the many things that we have to be scared of is people have less access to vaccines, you know. Turns out those vaccines were doing something. They were really doing something. And we didn't know it till they were gone. The main point of this story, of course, has nothing to do with public health. It is that.
Why can we talk about this?
So the gentleman who is leading America's public hantavirus response, who sort of you know made his debut in a press conference earlier this week, is a man named Dyer Bristein. He is an important expert, and he went up and he did the whole press release thing, and then CNN started like Googling him. And that's when they found out that this guy is a urologist who specializes in penile implants, Ben.
I have questions.
Do you? But
I think my first question is how do penile implants work? can someone explain this to me? I feel like this is falls outside of my very extensive medical expertise.
Yeah, I think that you're honestly just saying that to you know, avoid discussion about your own penile implant surgery.
just one of them. How generous of you.
Yeah, I'd really like to speculate a lot about how penile implants work. But the truth is that if you are not up to date, you can actually check out Brian Christine, the good doctor.
Okay.
Out his YouTube channel, and he. Well,
okay, how would I find that?
Well, you know, his series is titled "Erection Connection."
It sounds like a gay porn.
Also, dude is 62 years old, and I'm not saying that plays into some of my thoughts about boomers, but it does.
Yeah, well, you know, with his area of expertise, he could be active for decades to come.
Oh, jeez. So, yeah, so I guess what I was trying to say there is that Trump surrounds himself with the best people. And RFK Jr. has raised the bar so that only the best people are associated.
I feel like this story is going to end with this doctor having been Trump's doctor. And that's why he was fired. Or J.D. Vance. I can see that as well.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I guess, so, like, technically, I don't want to be making fun of erectile dysfunction. I know it's something that, like, you know, it's an issue. You know,
by all means,
everyone deserves a boner. You know, everyone deserves a boner, right?
Really? But, everyone?
Yeah, it's part of the Medicare for All promise. But it's interesting because you might actually characterize penile enhancement as being a kind of gender affirming surgery. And I wonder if he and RFK Jr. are like chatting about that behind the scenes. Do you think?
You know, it's funny. I've gotten to this point in our discussion about Dr. Brian Christine. And only just now did I wonder, how does the penile implant expert know anything about hantavirus, which is a public health issue?
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Which I realized
that was far
the more important question, but I got really distracted by this issue of penile implants.
Yeah, no. Yes. What I was trying to suggest is that it's funny that the penis doctor is now our hantavirus expert.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense now. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Just so we're all cleared up there. So audience, know that your hantavirus health is in good hands.
Yeah, while we're crowdsourcing, I feel like this episode is mostly about us being confused and asking our audience for help. So while we're at it, I'd like to crowdsource the question of what is the plausible career pathway from penile implant to public health virus outbreak expert?
I feel like this is like, actually, this is very interesting because this is probably like the reverse of my story, right? Like I started out studying American culture and pornography and then eventually healthcare policy. This guy, it's a parallel. It's a direct parallel.
See, anything is possible, really. Maybe we should support Dr. Christine.
I want to support Dr. Christine, especially if he's going to keep this hantavirus in check. Shout out, by the way, to Lindy, our good friend Lindy Hearn, expert on Medicare for All, who's in the comments with need a laugh, cry, vomit emoji. Yes, let's get to work on this.
Yes.
Laugh, cry, vomit all emoji. Right. For all. So with that, I mean.
Well, I'm glad we could end on an uplifting story.
Oh.
Yay.
It should become really clear by the end of this episode that when Ben and I are alone, we're basically 13-year-old boys. So I'm glad you guys got to see a little piece of that. Glad to give you the latest updates on how we're getting fucked and not getting fucked, depending on whether or not you got that penile implant. Okay, before I make any more jokes.
We better stop. We better cut it right now.
I am going to turn over to an interview that I did earlier this week with Isabella Ariza. She is a local activist in Corpus Christi, where Healthcare Now, our national office, which is my house, is based. And she's talking a little bit about our water crisis and its public health implications. So thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed the interview.
Bye, y'all.
Hi, everyone. I am so happy to welcome you here to a very special episode of the Medicare for All podcast. As you know, we predominantly focus on healthcare issues at the Medicare for All podcast, but this is an issue that might not seem related, but I think it's an important story to tell, and it's deeply intertwined with all of the things that we are talking about every day about our culture that doesn't necessarily value life over profit. So the story takes you to Corpus Christi, Texas, a place that you probably have not heard of. And if you have, maybe it was a vague reference on the sitcom Community. But the point is that Corpus Christi is a tiny little city with 500,000 people, and we are running out of water. Within a few weeks, Corpus Christi could be the first city in the country to run out of water. And so I brought Isabel here. Isabel Ariza is a local activist. As you all know, I talk about this all the time on the pod, but our home base here for our Healthcare Now national office is my house in Corpus Christi, Texas. And so this is happening right in our backyard, and we really want to get into it. So excited to have you here, Isabel. Isabel Ariza was born and raised in Corpus Christi. She knows the territory. She got her PhD in sociology from Boston College, and then she came back to Corpus as a to teach sociology. She's now an associate professor of social sciences at Del Mar Community College. And for the purposes of this conversation, she co-founded the local grassroots group for the Greater Good, which has been advocating for quality of life issues in the Coastal Bend since 2016. She's amazing. She is an icon in our city. Everyone should know more about Isabel. So Isabel, thank you so much for being here and for agreeing to talk with us about this.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. It is so good to have you. And such a terrible situation. Why? Why are we here? So, I guess before we actually launch into what the situation is here in Corpus, why don't we actually just talk a little bit about you? Like, how did you get involved with this? How did you go from your academic career to being really one of the leading voices in Corpus Christi to protect our water? This woman has been leading this fight for so many years. And I wonder how you got there, right? How did you go from professor to water protector?
Yeah, it really is ironic. I don't know. So I was classically trained in terms of like academics that it's not our job to get involved in things as a researcher, as a scholar. You're supposed to ask good questions and have sound methodologies. And like, I drank that Kool-Aid, you know, that I could come back to Corpus and actually teach at A&M Corpus and, you know, have my dream job in the community that I was raised in. I really just got involved in this stuff kind of by accident. And I think it's because I am from here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had 3 water bowls in 10 months. And I just to keep it really short, but one of the things that I always teach in my intro classes is that sociology is the most needed quality of mind. It's an important toolkit. It gives us a way of knowing and understanding the world that's different than the way that culturally we're raised to think about the world in terms of like individual responsibility and agency.
Sure.
And so I really felt like, you know, I'm teaching these classes and I want students to have this kind of transformative education. And when the stuff was happening in Corpus, we had 3 water bowls in 10 months. And
do you want to explain what that means?
Oh, sure. So basically what wound up happening was the city changed the way that it was managing its water. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they weren't able to keep their levels stable.
Yeah.
And so whenever they like vacillate outside of a certain range, they have to declare a water boil.
Water boil,
that there's like these markers in the water that suggest that there could be like, they're kind of like, they raise flags that there could be some instability and then maybe like E. coli, like problems that could make people sick.
Right.
And so, after the 3rd one, I was like, this is it. I'm just going to go to city council because they had those emergency meeting and I wanted to see what was going on. Cause I also lived in an area where the pipes are older. And so our area would be one of the last, you know, places to be released from the water boil.
Yeah.
And so I went to that meeting and there were some people that were there that were talking about the water as like an inconvenience for them personally. But then there were other people that were talking about it as how like the broader community or segments of the population were being impacted. Like people on dialysis, the elderly, right? Low-income individuals. And so I was like, ooh, I need to talk to them. Because they think about things like I do, right? And,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's really how For the Greater Good was born. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And it was just like, let's get together and learn about our water. And then the more we got to learn, the more we were like,
yeah, no. I mean, we always quote, Che Guevara saying that, like, the secret to organizing is, one conversation after another. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I love that you just started by talking to people. And that is very much your style of activism. And one that's necessary here in Texas, I think, especially, right, when people can be very politically entrenched in a way that I think is sometimes unexamined. So when you can get people to actually think about their self-interest,
yeah,
things happen. Things shift.
Yes. Yeah. So much so, yes, wow.
So that's amazing. So you are a daughter of Corpus Christi, came back here and got involved in this fight. The current, we've been, you know, Corpus Christi has been dealing with water problems, I'm sure, since you were a child. It's an issue that has only gotten worse over time. But the current crisis we're in is this shortage. And I wondered if you could just, like, maybe give, like, the short-ish version of that for folks who are somewhere else in the country and have no idea what's going on here.
Okay. So Corpus had plenty of water, and then around, and we have been in an area that had refineries. We have a refinery row in our community where there's lots of industry in that area.
We should mention that we're a port city. And so that's one of the reasons that we have so many refineries. Around.
Right. And then in 2015, I think the big thing for us was in 2015, basically the federal government allowed for oil exports. Up until then, they had really protected, like, we weren't supposed to be doing that. And then when that happened, the port exploded. Not exploded. Like the stuff coming through the port increased exponentially.
Right, right.
And so we have an economic development corporation that's kind of like public-private, and they recruit industry here in economic development. Development group.
When you say high volume water users, do you mean like people like me who like to take long showers?
No. Thank you for asking. No, it's basically like industry, plastics, petrochemical, a steel mill, ammonia plant, those kinds of water users, where they're using more than 100,000 gallons a day. And so like our biggest, so in 2017, City of Corpus Christi signed basically like an MOU with Exxon Sabic, which is the Saudi family, promising them, I believe, up to 25 million gallons of water a day. And then they promised Steel Dynamics another 5 to 6. This is after Valero was using 7 to 9.
Yeah.
And then other industries were also using millions of gallons of water a day. So we had this water buffer, and they basically promised it all away to these two companies. And then industry was expanding. And the other thing that's really important, I think this is the kicker too, the city, the high volume water users, like five of them here in Corpus, coupled with the city's water department, actually wrote municipal code to allow those industrial customers to pay a small fee, 25 cents per 1,000 gallons, and they would be able to avoid all drought surcharges. And drought surcharges are the way that the city tries to make businesses and people reduce their water usage.
So basically, just to make sure I got this clear, we've got these major corporations that are coming in. They're helping to write the laws that allow them to get their water at a discount so that they can take it, use it for business, and make sure that it never hits my long shower.
Right.
Oh, great.
Right. Right. No, that's exactly what wound up happening. And what I've come to appreciate now is that back then when that drought exemption surcharge fee was introduced. So we've been around for 10 years. And I remember, like, we had committed to actually going to city council meetings and watching them, and to watch all city councils like falling over themselves, thanking the port and port industries for everything that they're doing for us. It was so weird for me that, like, my brain could not compute what I was seeing. And so I think that they really, like, all the votes would be like 9-0, no discussion for whatever industry wanted. And I think that they were just banking on they would be able to get a desal plant. They didn't have to have good plans. They didn't have to have good permits. They would just get what they wanted. And TCEQ has always given industry what they want. And so that's really why we're here.
That's our state electric company, by the way. Yeah, for folks who are not in Texas, I have to do a Texas to U.S. translation whenever we talk about this. All right, so basically, we're in this situation now where we have been profiteered out of water, and they are telling us now that we are going to be running out of water in a matter of weeks.
So worst case scenario, it could be the beginning of the summer. But now there's like saying September. I mean,
had a storm, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. They're like, yay. Well, now we're at 8.7% or whatever. I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is still more than 90% empty. Our reservoirs are still, our Western reservoirs, the where we've been getting our water since, I don't know, the 60s and 80s, depending on
when you're looking. Sure, sure. So, I mean, this has been, I feel like everyone in Corpus right now is very angry. And I see it showing up in all sorts of different ways from people actually talking about politics, which I didn't hear when I first moved here 5 years ago, all the way to people being really mean in line at the HEB. I think it's just like, it's really stressful for everyone involved. There's this kind of existential crisis, right? And part of it is that we don't really know what happens when we run into when we run out of water, because as you say, right, they're kicking the can down the road. They're like, oh well, it stormed last night, we don't have to worry about this.
Yeah, storm. We'll be here like 3 more days.
Yeah. So there's like no discussion of what is actually going to happen. But so I just wanted to talk a little bit, though, like really get into the health aspect of it, to talk about what could be some of the possible health implications of this particular shortage. And then also, like, as you've been talking about it, right, it's the story of Corpus Christi and water and business. This is a war that's been going on for many, many years, right? So, I mean, the costs of that are not just this current shortage, but also the kind of pollution that's been dumped into the water. So, yeah, just talk a little bit about what kind of an impact that is having and has the, you know, has the chance to have.
I really appreciate that you're focusing on the health components of it and the public health issues, right? Because that's something that's like people aren't talking about at all. And we've been trying to raise the issue around, because people are like, well, you know, if you, because we're also, our group is against the desalination project that they're proposing, which I guess we could talk about another time, but it's like, I mean, we're talking about 25% curtailment on top of residents already reducing their water usage, almost 20% in the last 3 years.
That's right.
And so people aren't flushing their toilets. Schools were concerned around, right, having children and them flushing their toilets, because we're going to be told to save water. Does that mean that they're not going to flush, right? And it's one thing when you're at home with your people and your germs. It's another thing when you've got thousands of students, right, on campus. So I think that, like, in terms of just the daily living, you know, people are like, oh, but gas is going to go up. Well, you know what? I'm really sorry that the people that are in office right now are putting profits over people. And so this is a consequence of that.
Yeah.
But I mean, the other thing is too, like I was thinking about, you know, in the context of Medicare for all, you know, if we want to have affordable healthcare, one of the things that we need to do is create conditions so that people can live the healthiest lives possible.
Absolutely.
And so, the water that they're proposing to like tap into now, and that they've almost spent $1 billion or earmarked $1 billion for different water sources, like wells and reverse osmosis and using gray water. But none of that's for us, Jillian, none of it. It's
all for the businesses. Industry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what does that do? That allows industry to keep operating and emitting. And so we have one of the reasons why industries come over here, they're promised cheap water, cheap electricity, weak regulations, and cheap labor.
Yeah.
And so we do have health issues that are related to all the industry that's around us. And so like, that's one of our positions too. Like not only for us personally, like we don't want desalination. We don't want that panicked pillaging of the water aquifers.
Right.
Because it's just for industrial expansion, and that's not healthy for our communities either.
Right. Right. Absolutely. You know, you spoke before about how one of the things that had kind of gotten you into this was the experience of going through the water boils and seeing how water disruption affected like particular populations of Corpus Christi. And you mentioned folks on dialysis, elders, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about a little bit more about like what populations in our city are most vulnerable if water prices are to rise to the point where they can't afford it, where people are really, really rationing water?
Right. So, and that's actually, they're already talking about changing our water rates because of all the spending that they've done on these other projects.
What a surprise.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's on top of all of the other, like, they are, charging fees on all kinds of things, reducing services. That's something else that happened with us too. Like they limited the amount of trash collection and big brush collection, you know, a couple of cycles ago too, right? So there's at the same time that they're investing all these resources in providing industry water, they're taking away resources from us that have an impact on our quality of life, which again, kind of thinking about that, right? That we, our taxes get pulled together and we can do things more efficiently at scale, you know, in terms of city services. And when the city scales back on those, it's not that those expenses or needs go away. It means that the burden is shifted onto individual households. And so households have to spend more to get their basic needs met, which means that, right, that we're not talking about cutting back on luxuries. We're talking about cutting back on necessities.
Yeah.
The average household income in Corpus is lower than the state average. Our poverty rates are...
And we're in Texas. Sorry, I just want to emphasize that.
Right.
Like, we already have very low incomes here. Yeah.
Right. And we already... And Texas, by definition, right, also has very poor public services.
Yep. You know,
and they're hard to get access to. Corpus Christi alone has 30,000 residents that are on a waiting list for affordable housing.
Yeah.
I went to a neighboring county to do a presentation about the Fair Water Amendment that we're doing two nights ago, and I was reading up on Aransas County. 42% of their renters spend more than 30% of their income just to pay for their rent. So, yep. I mean, we're talking about, and our my water bill, it's just a family of three. We use less than 4,000 gallons of water. Was $173 this past
Jesus
month.
Christ.
And
you're really serious about this shit too, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, like you look at someone like me and I'm kind of bad at conservation, right? I'm new to it. I'm getting used to it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then I see you on the Facebooks and you're like, you're using the water in very careful and conservative ways. You are definitely like making sure that you're not using more water than you need, right? Mm-hmm. And you're still, you could go broke paying that water bill.
Yeah. And I just think about all of those people that aren't below poverty, but that also are like just slightly above, right? Because that's where that safety net, there is no safety net for them.
Yes.
That's absolutely right. And so the city's even talking about, I mean, they're saying now that they're not going to find people, but in the drought contingency plan, it actually says that if you violate, like you break the rules more than twice, they cut your water off for a month and then you can reconnect. I'm like, what are people supposed to do?
Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. Okay, hold on. Sorry. You're fucking blowing my mind here. I hadn't heard this part. So, okay. So they're saying that they can literally cut off your water service.
If you are a chronic violator of your allocation, right? If you go over the water amount, like there's
shit, my long showers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that this is the thing that's so crazy. Okay. So sure. If you're like, I remember saying, you know, I want you to feel guilty brushing your teeth with the water running. I'm like, okay, that's 2 to 4 gallons. Meanwhile, Exxon, right? Gulf Coast Growth Ventures, they're literally using, they can use up to 18,889 gallons per minute, per minute. Like we should, it's not about us, right? Industry needs to curtail. Industry and those corporations that didn't design their plans to scale back, you should then turn off because you were so arrogant that you could have all the water. You know how our lake levels get, you know, like that's the other thing. Turn them off. Let's watch what happens to the lake. Maybe it'll wake people up. I think it is waking people up.
I think it is too. I mean, I think it is too. But you know, the truth is though that like even like going around talking to people, watching comments show up on Facebook. Of course, Facebook is where our worst angels come out. But regardless, you know, a lot of people who seem to kind of maybe still not quite be framing this in a way that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So like I guess this story, you know, really struck me as important to tell here. As I said before, like not just because it's happening in my backyard and therefore is, you know, important to me as a narcissist. But also, I mean, also that it seems to be like an omen of this kind of like water shortage as a critical public health issue, which yes. I think that like everyone in the country is going to have to deal with. But then it also just seems like such a direct parallel to healthcare. We have here public goods, right? Things right. that exist purely to keep people alive, right? And in, you know, the case of water, it literally comes from God or Marx or the earth or whoever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting here and we're turning it into a commodity, right? And this is just like a constant, you know, thing with our culture, right? Mm-hmm. Anything that will keep people alive, anything that people really need to survive, we're going to turn it into a commodity that we can buy and sell. And so I wondered, as you're going around and you're talking to people, you know, a lot of people are still entrenched in that mindset that these big corporations are our only means to survival, that they're the ones that are going to keep our city alive. How do you kind of get past that mentality? What do you say to folk?
So I feel like, and because I've been talking to a lot of people, I almost feel like the Jehovah's Witness of this water crisis, you know, like.
Yeah, you see her walking around town, knocking on doors.
Yes. I'm like, I'm going to be hanging out over here. Come by, you know? And so, I mean, I do. I go to HEB with my clipboard. I always have my clipboard so that, like, if there's an opportunity. So what do I do? Basically what I've been trying to, and it's getting easier. I actually feel like this water crisis has helped.
Yeah.
Show how awful they are. And I just like basically say, like, look at what they've done to our lakes. Like, they are willing to suck them dry for their profits. And so I have no problems. Like, these are billion-dollar corporations and they want you to use less. So whenever I can point it out, I always do, you know. And I think I've even called like some of the city council bootlickers.
I know you have. I'm positive you have.
And I'm just like, I'm not going to be polite anymore. You know why? Because what they're doing is violent. Maybe they're not killing us overtly or, you know, but you can see them like, but that is exactly what's happening to us. People are going to die. People aren't going to get their dialysis. People aren't going to be able to pay their bills. Their lights are going to be turned off. Their water's going to be turned off. Why?
Yeah.
So Valero can have like, so that you can have a plastic wrapper around your plastic.
Yeah. No, it's wild. And so making the case to people that human life is actually more important than plastic.
Right.
Is a convincing argument these days.
And I'll say, oh yeah, you're right. I don't need to wash dishes. I don't need to flush my toilet. You're right. What was I thinking? Sorry that I don't want you to have $6 gas. So I won't flush.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. You know, it's again, same parallel with the healthcare industry, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, this is all on you, right? You know, the problem isn't that I'm not going to give you any preventative care. The problem is that you are too fat or you are not, you know, your bad habits or your lifestyle is the issue or whatever. Right. This is kind of trying to displace like the kind of awful things that corporations are doing and trying to get individual people to internalize it as guilt and make up for it. It's fucking wild.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So Isabel, what are we going to do to fix this thing? And can we fix it? And is it too late? And should I be looking at a home in Mexico?
Well, they have nationalized healthcare.
I know. They've got like a liberal Jewish lady president and universal healthcare and pretty excited.
I'm somebody, I often say things always seem impossible until they're not. And then somebody comes along and writes the story to explain how the impossible became possible.
Yeah.
Right. And so I try to hold on to that because I also feel like, you know, there were people who dared to dream that like we could vote, you know, that I could go to school, you know, so people like me, people like us. And so, I think we just have to keep talking to people. We're doing the Fair Water Amendment here, which is the petition. to try to end industry's drought exemption, which basically means that like make them pay the drought surcharge, right? Yes. So like right now they pay 31 cents per 1,000 gallons. If we go into the emergency level stage one, they're still going to pay 31 cents when they should be paying $12. Mm. You know, so like we're doing that. If you know anybody from Corpus, ask them to sign the petition. We have different stations. There is the fairwateramendment.org. We have like a little calendar there where we're going to be posting up at where if people want to come and sign petitions, you can also email us. There's a real human that's like keeping track of that so that we can make connections. So I've been trying to go anybody that's willing to let me talk to them about what's happening. I go with my clipboard. If you're having a birthday party, you know, there's registered voters there. I will be there.
That's amazing. And I actually do know of a birthday party that you can hit up that you're invited to later on this month. we'll go do karaoke together. Yeah. And get some signatures. That is spectacular. I really just appreciate how you are fighting for this and how you are, you know, Corpus is not a political city in a lot of ways, right? People here don't think about themselves in terms right. of political actors. And I think that you do a really good job of reminding people that our everyday lives are political and that doesn't have to be contentious. It can mean right. us coming together and actually fighting for shared prosperity.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tony.
No.
And thank you for everything you're doing.
Very little, very little. I'm just taking my long showers and making a podcast. but I like to be able to amplify what other people are doing good. Yeah. I just really appreciate you. For those folks who are not here in Texas, please help us to get this story out. It is really essential that people know about what's happening, because let me tell you, if it is not happening in your city, it will.
It will.
This will touch the entire nation. And so this is the next wave of privatization, the next wave of corporate theft. So again, thank you, Isabel. Thank you for all your work. Looking forward to fighting side by side with you in the future.
Yes.
Exactly. I also want to thank our podcast team, especially our amazing audio editor, Craig Stanton. Please, everyone, remember to like, subscribe, comment, and share with your friends. This podcast is a project of the Healthcare Now Education Fund, and you can support the pod by going to www.healthcare-now.org and clicking on the donate tab to send us a little bit of love in the form of resources. I will use it to buy Isabel a bottle of water. All right, everybody. Thanks, y'all. Everybody stay safe and stay dangerous.